The following content has been provided by New St. Andrews College in Moscow, Idaho. For more information, visit us online at www.nsa.edu.
Okay, so it gives me, it's been a fantastic couple of days for Wordsmithing, and it gives me a great pleasure to introduce the final installment of Wordsmithing and to introduce our speaker who, before moving here, was a neighbour of mine in Oxford. Our gardens almost backed onto one another. It's a delight to welcome Peter Hitchens, who is author, journalist, commentator on political things in England and Europe and America. And he's been speaking on the art of journalism in the last couple of days, and we're going to finish off with him speaking on the defense of the indefensible and how to avoid it. So please give a very warm welcome to Mr. Peter Hitchens.
Thank you so much. There were no border disputes, fortunately. There were being enough buffer states between us that we have now advanced into the adjoining area in a sort of Crimean extension of our territory. So we're a good deal closer to you. Defending the indefensible, don't do it. It is a grave danger in the modern world, and it's one, a sort of pronged defense onto which the enemy will wish to lure you. This is an almost wholly political address which I propose to give you, but it obviously has a very strong Christian undertone, which I hope will become apparent during what I say and any exchanges we have afterwards. But it is most fundamentally about the huge problem which we now have with Russia. And when I say the huge problem which we now have with Russia, I do not mean that Russia is about to launch an attack upon us, but that we have an immense and deep and troubling misunderstanding of that country, which may lead us into serious error and possibly into war, which we should strive to avoid. The problem with the defense of the indefensible is this. You are probably all far too young to remember the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War. But there was a particularly memorable moment in it which struck me very strongly because I was one of those really against whom these words were aimed. When Mikhail Gorbachev began to dismantle the Soviet Union and Soviet communism, many people, including me, did not believe that he really meant to do what he claimed to be doing. We thought that it was some sort of fraudulent attempt to disarm us morally so that we would be enfeebled in any coming conflict. And it was a reasonable supposition to make. Communist countries are not necessarily honest. They are devious. They were failing in many other ways to make an impact. It would have been a strategy worth adopting. However, it did become apparent as time went by that Gorbachev, although he probably didn't understand fully what he was doing, did intend actually to dismantle the system of Soviet communism and to withdraw the Soviet Empire from many hundreds of thousands of square miles of territory which it had formerly sat upon heavily with tanks and troops. And there was a press conference given by Mr. Gorbachev's then spokesman, a silky, witty man called Gennady Gerasimov, who eventually became too witty for his own good and was dispatched to be ambassador to Portugal, but at that time was still very, very close, I'll tell you why in a minute, very close to his leader. And he was besieged during some announcement about perestroika or glasnost by skeptical, particularly American conservative journalists, treating him with total mistrust. And after a while, Gerasimov just smiled and said, "Gentlemen, I am very sorry. I owe you an apology. We have done to you the cruelest thing that anyone could possibly do to his fellow creatures. We have deprived you of an enemy." And it was absolutely true. The Western world, and I do not merely mean the Western world's military-industrial complex and those who benefit from a constant state of preparedness for war, all those who had tried to create, during the era of the Cold War, an atmosphere of mingled menace and patriotism in which it was actually only possible to be a patriot if you engaged also in an ideological struggle against another nation, suddenly faced an enormous yawning vacuum. What was it that they were in future going to worry about? What was it that they were in future going to persuade the nation to defend itself against? And they strove mightily. I believe at one stage they were reduced to General Noriega of Panama as the substitute for the Soviet Union. Anything would do. The tiny island of Grenada, Saddam Hussein, the supposed new Hitler and or Stalin, depending on your political persuasion, and indeed Slobodan Milosevic, the titan of the Balkans, another one of these selected enemies. All failed because none of them was convincing. It is completely impossible to believe that any of these figures or their countries or their ideologies, if they even had any, remotely resembled the enormous power and menace of Soviet communism, which was genuine. And I'm still very much of the view that the Soviet Union, as it was before Gorbachev, was indeed an evil empire. There was no question of it. I visited it. It was a filthy, dishonest, repressive, miserable place. And what was even worse, it believed itself to be good and sought to expand itself into the territory of neighboring nations and crushed and very savagely crushed those within its borders or indeed within its power who challenged it. And we are well rid of it. And let us be of absolutely unmistakably certain of that fact. That thing was bad and is over. And I can quite understand why some people might feel an urge to try to recreate something similar. But all this has failed. And for many, many years, the failure had become almost a state of normality. And nothing would do. All these substitutes had failed. And indeed, the Saddam Hussein Hitler attempt had not merely ended in farce, but in tragedy as well. People had begun to see that this constant search abroad for enemies, for wars of choice, for enemies of choice indeed, for conflicts of choice, was not doing us or the world any good at all. And then suddenly, whoever it is who thinks of these things had a brainwave. Why not just go back to being terrified of Russia? If you don't know anything about Russia at all, if you don't know anything about the Soviet Union at all, it is perfectly possible to think that they are the same thing. Now, of course, that as a precondition ought to mean that every intelligent, literate, and educated person in the Western world should be completely immune to any attempt to suggest that Russia is like the Soviet Union. However, you will have noticed this is not so. Most of the supposedly intellectual classes, most of the political classes, particularly the media classes, have fallen not merely with idiotic unanimity, but also with great enthusiasm for the idea that Vladimir Putin is the new Stalin and that his Russia is the new Soviet Union. And it has become, in an amazingly short period of time, the conventional wisdom of the foreign policy elite and of everybody who listens to them, and increasingly of the military. There is a man called General Breedlove, who has been let loose by the US military, who's actually been allowed to make amazingly political statements on this subject. Now, I began to wonder what on earth could be done about this. The difficulty with all the other people who I just listed was also that if one began to say, look, actually, Slobodan Milosevic isn't what you say he is, people would say, oh, right, you're defending Slobodan Milosevic. Or you think that that kind of person is the sort of person we should leave in power. Of course, the answer to that deep down is true. It is because I believe that any sovereign country has the absolute freedom to be left alone by any other sovereign country, and that we have no business intervening in other people's countries, however much we dislike their regimes, and the quality and character of somebody's regime is not the issue as to whether we go to war with them. Indeed, if it were, this country and my country, if we were simply judging on whether to go to war with other nations on the basis of the revolting nature of their regimes, this country and my country would be at war with Saudi Arabia and the People's Republic of China, which seemed to me to outdistance all other states on the face of the earth in terms of despotism, repression, absence of the rule of law, and general menace to those who live under their rule. And yet, funnily enough, both these nations are closely allied to us, and we are indeed deeply in debt to them and do not say a word about what's wrong with them, which makes, to some extent, a nonsense, it seems to me, of the self-righteous frenzy we might get into about the regime in Russia or in Syria or indeed in Slobodan Milosevic's Serbia. I just mention this because it's a skimming of the surface, which is only the beginning of thought on this matter. As soon as you begin to think about the nature of propaganda about foreign policy in the modern world, none of it makes any kind of logical sense. I can offer, after this meeting is over or under questioning, suggestions as to what you might read to put you right on it, but it is straightforwardly, self-evidently to any questioning mind, wrong. And then I thought, how can I, without becoming a defender of the indefensible, without becoming an apologist for Vladimir Putin, who I do regard as a sinister tyrant, and whose internal actions I do believe to have been in many ways indefensible in any moral terms, how can I actually connect with a Western audience and explain to them why it is that what they're being told isn't true, and why is it that the task is so difficult? And I eventually came to the conclusion that the reason why most people didn't understand it was that most people did not have my fantastic advantage, that I lived from 1990 to 1992 in Moscow. I arrived in the Soviet Union, I left Russia. I saw the thing collapse, and I lived among the people while it was going on, and I observed exactly what took place. So let me be a little impressionistic. First of all, when I arrived in Moscow, I was extremely anti-Soviet, and I felt that to be anti-Russian was pretty much the same thing. On one occasion while I was living in Moscow, I went one Monday morning to Vilnius, the capital of the then Soviet Republic of Lithuania, because there was some stirring for independence in that republic, and was dragged into, for the second time in my life, quite unintentionally, a genuine war zone. Suddenly, we were sitting in the press conference, suddenly that awful, tearing calico noise of machine gun fire, which is so unmistakable and so frightening, could be heard afar off. And we all, as we were reporters, and this was our duty, though in my case with a great deal of trembling and sweat, hurried towards the sound of this to find the most extraordinary events taking place. One in particular comes to mind. As we arrived, one man was being taken away whose eye had been shot out by a Soviet soldier. They were demonstrating outside the Lithuanian press building against censorship. And a large number of Lithuanians had gathered on the steps of this building. And an officer brought up to face them a detachment of something like 25 Red Army soldiers who were Central Asians and obviously had no sympathy whatever with the Lithuanians and been chosen for this purpose. And he told the Lithuanians in Russian that they must disperse, and they said no, they were not going, and they stood there. Whereupon, and I was standing as far from them as I am standing from you, at the side, whereupon he ordered the Red Army troops to raise their Kalashnikovs, and which I remember had bayonets fixed on them. And then he gave the Lithuanians another instruction to leave, which they defied, and then he ordered his troops to fire. And an astonishing thing happened. I mean, this was an illustration of the demoralization of Soviet power at the time as it happened. They opened fire, and there was a great deal of noise and clouds of smoke. The Lithuanians, I've never seen such courage, simply stood there. And when they realized, before I realized, for obvious reasons, that they had actually been fired on with blanks, they came down the steps and they kicked those Red Army soldiers and beat them until they fled. But this was the nature of what was taking place. Later on that evening, we had all just gone to bed when a huge explosion could be heard at the television tower about 2 miles away, and several of us got into hired cars with Lithuanian drivers and chased the tanks which were heading towards the television tower there to find quite large numbers of people with serious bullet wounds lying dead, who were later classified by the Soviet authorities, I have to tell you, as traffic accident victims. I can assure you they were not. And again, the people were standing there as bullets flew, completely refusing to do anything. Well, I came back from that event, which was inconclusive, but ended in the independence of Lithuania, in a fury at all Russians, even Russians who had, up till that point, I'd regarded as friends. I began to feel extremely hostile to. So do not imagine for any instant that I had become some kind of soppy Russophile as a result of living there, or that I was in that state. But it was only 6-7 months after that that I was in Moscow when the putsch, the August 1991 putsch staged by communist hardliners took place. Tanks actually came down my street. They were, there's an extraordinary thing about tanks when they come down the street on a summer morning, which nobody tells you, they turn up a huge amount of dust. And it is actually rather a romantic sight. And I thought, oh, this is it. Then that happens. This means the hardliners have hit back. This is the end of all hope that the Soviet Union will be reformed. We're going to go back to the age of Brezhnev and possibly Stalin. And then to my astonishment, the whole thing collapsed in a matter of 2 days. And what I also saw walking through the streets of Moscow later is something I've never seen anybody else record. All the trash cans, which were urn-shaped, gray urn-shaped, were full of burning substances. And I went over to see what they were, and they were Communist Party cards. Thousands and thousands of people, almost everyone in Moscow who had become a member of the Communist Party to protect themselves for career reasons, had taken their cards and put them collectively into the trash cans and burnt them. As I said, I've never seen anyone else describe this, but it struck me. The whole thing was so exhilarating that I was singing hymns as I drove around the city. It was such an astonishing lightening of the atmosphere and an end of something terrible. A few months later, I managed to get permission to go to the great Crimean naval station in Sevastopol, which is a very beautiful place, by the way, which anybody who has a chance to visit should go to. And again, I come from a naval family and was astonished and moved in many different ways to see how the ships were lying sunk down by the stern, down by the bow, tipped over on one side, scuttled in the creeks and inlets around that city. The huge blue water global navy, which Admiral Sergei Gorshkov had been trying to build for decades to rival the US fleet, had been effectively scuttled. The Soviet Union's attempt at world power was over. So two things had happened visibly, tangibly, palpably in front of me. Soviet communism had died, and Soviet global ambition had died. And it seems to me you could not any longer regard Russia as the same place. And the subsequent collapse of Soviet power over the Warsaw Pact countries and over many parts of the Soviet Union, which had previously been sovereign Soviet territory, and indeed in some cases had been sovereign Russian territory before 1917, this collapse of 800,000 square miles of territory given up, more or less without a shot, between Berlin and Minsk. One of the most enormous peaceful cessions of territory and an even larger withdrawal from the Central Asian states, which nobody knows anything about, but I do a bit. And the shrinkage of this country to the state it was now in, as well as its abandonment of the old ideology, were just things which seemed to me to be so significant it was impossible to ignore. And then, I have to add, I had learnt something about Russia, which also people who live, as I do, in a small island surrounded by deep salt water, or you who live in a continent with an ocean on one side and an ocean on the other, and Mexico at the bottom and Canada at the top, should be aware of. Russia does not have this blessing. Russia has, in fact, no real defensible physical borders at all. Where you have Mexico and Canada, Russia has China and Germany. And it has also in time had a very great enemy in Poland. The only invasion of the United States which I know of was conducted by my own country in 1814 when we attempted to burn Washington, D.C. and made a rather poor job of it. Russia, by contrast, has been invaded by Poland, by Germany, at least twice, by France, by Britain, and of course by the Tatars. And here I come to the sentimental part of this discourse, which is the lovely street in South Moscow called Ulitsa Balsha Ordinka, which means the Street of the Great Horde. Now this street is a contradiction of communist Moscow, which is a festival of concrete, which looks very much like the thoughts of Comrade Stalin. huge concrete blocks and more huge concrete blocks, everything cuboid, everything without detail or love or human scale, gigantism, moronic, brutal, and totalitarian. Belchior Ordinka, by contrast, is full of small, low 19th century classical houses with front gardens, decayed in the time that I was there, cracked, neglected, but it was possible to imagine in those houses the sort of people that Tolstoy wrote about living. And halfway along the street, a church with the name of the Consolation of All Sorrows. Russians do very good church names, but I think that's the best of them all. And you could not square this street with the Soviet Union. Add to it the reason for its name. The reason for its name is that this is the road round down which the Tatars of the Golden Horde would come every 5 years to collect their tribute. For Moscow is not actually deep in Europe. The Ural Mountains are not really the frontier of Europe. Moscow is the frontier town at the edge of Europe, in reality. And in this country and in this culture, there is a very curious fact. Now, many people say silly things about the languages of other countries. There is a story told in Britain, I don't know whether you know it here, it may have been made up by one of our leading politicians, Baroness Shirley Williams, but it may be true, that George W. Bush once informed some British politicians that the French had no word for entrepreneur. So I'm not anxious to make that kind of mistake, and I've checked what I'm about to say with Russian friends who know their language a good deal better than I do. The principal Russian word for safety, and Russian is a word with many synonyms and they use them all, but the word for security and safety generally used in Russia is the word bezpečnost. It actually features in the name of the KGB, the Komitet Gosudarstvennoj Bezpečnosti, the Committee for State Security. And it is a very strange word because bez, which begins it, is the Russian for without. And so the word for security, bezpečnost, means without danger. The state of danger and risk is regarded by Russians as the natural default state of life. And that is why Russia is so different from us. Also because, imagine, say, for instance, that this country had on one border the Middle East, as Russia does, on another border China, as Russia does, and close to another border Germany, which has invaded it twice, you might actually have an excuse for having a Department for Homeland Security. As it is, I don't believe that you do. But I think they do, and I think it's worth putting that in mind. To extend the parallel a little bit further as to what has been going on in Ukraine, imagine that the United States had lost the Cold War rather than won it. Imagine that as a result, the territories seized from Mexico in 1848 had to be returned, but that somehow or other you'd managed to do a deal with an expanded Mexico to share San Diego as your principal Pacific naval port, which was the arrangement in Sevastopol until recently. The Russian and Ukrainian navies shared the same harbor and glared at each other across it. And imagine that the actual area around San Diego was a sort of American enclave in Mexico, in which there were American schools. But on the other hand, all the movie theaters were compelled to show films only in Spanish, and they couldn't show them in English. And that the school curriculum taught an anti-American version of history. And also imagine then that, say, at the other end of the United States, Quebec had been persuaded to secede from Canada as a result of large demonstrations and a sort of mob putsch in Montreal in which Russian politicians had played a leading part. And that the resulting independent state of Quebec had then signed a military and political agreement with Russia and had begun to install Russian military troops. Imagine how the United States might conceivably have reacted to such a move and how long an independent pro-Russian state in Quebec bordering several of the northeastern states of the United States would have survived without some sort of intervention. Because that is more or less a mirror image of what has happened in Russia over the past few years. A steady move into what had been turned into neutral territory by Russian withdrawal, by an alliance whose purpose seems to have, an alliance which seems to have no other purpose than to counter a Russian menace which doesn't exist. And when I say it doesn't exist, I think Russia's GDP is far smaller than that of Western Europe. And even with its recently expanded military, its military power is way below that of the NATO powers. It's hugely exaggerated as a military power, even if it wished to expand, which it can't afford to do because it is more or less bankrupt. And it's the mirror image that I've described is one thing, but the mirror image of the truth, which is what we're fed, is the other. Now, why is it? Why would it be that anybody would want to portray as an aggressor nation, a nation which had actually withdrawn from 800,000 square miles of territory and had absolutely no intention of reconquering them? What is going on here? Why do we fall for it? And I would appeal to you, and this is the purpose of what I'm saying, not to get trapped into saying, I think Vladimir Putin is wonderful or that the internal affairs of Russia are great, because as I've demonstrated over China and Saudi Arabia, that's not actually what our leaders care about at all. Ask whenever you are pressed and urged and propagandized into believing that we are entering a new Cold War with Russia and there is a Russian threat. Just ask for the details. What is the nature of this threat? How many tanks? How many troops does it involve? What movements are actually taking place which justify this claim? And wonder to yourself why it is that such an immense piece of dishonesty is being perpetrated upon you. And then return to that afternoon, long, long ago, when Gennady Gerasimov told us that they had done to us the cruelest thing that anyone could possibly do. They had deprived us of an enemy. And now I will tell you what happened to Gennady Gerasimov shortly after that. Again, some of you may remember that the Soviet Union at this time was not proving to be a huge economic success. Indeed, it was collapsing inwardly. But rumors began to spread that Mikhail Gorbachev had been nominated for a Nobel Prize. And at another press conference in the Moscow Foreign Ministry Press Center, Gerasimov was asked, what is this about your president getting a Nobel Prize? What is it for? And he said, well, it's certainly not for economics. And that's how he became ambassador to Portugal. And at that point, I think I would like to invite discussion and questions rather than carry on going on and on. Otherwise, it will begin to resemble the kind of speech they gave in the Soviet Union.
New St. Andrews College, thanks you for listening.